In earlier episodes, we looked at the historical reasons why we should reject the Apocrypha. In this episode, we're going to continue to explore this subject by looking at the rational reasons for rejecting the Apocrypha by actually looking within these documents themselves. What are some of these reasons that we would reject the Apocrypha? Well, for one, the Apocrypha contain magic incantations. In the Book of Tobit, which is really a sweet story, it's a love story about a father, Tobit, who's trying to marry off his son to a woman who has been through 7 husbands because they keep dying on her. And he's trying to fix up Tobias, his son, and Sarah, this woman. In the midst of it, he ends up going blind. It's kind of an interesting tale. But in this story, we discover that magic is being used to do 2 things. One, to get rid of demon possession, exorcism, and 2, to heal Tobit's eyes. In chapter 6, verse 7, the young man, Tobias, questioned the angel, "Brother Azariah, what medicinal value is there in the fish's heart and liver and in the gall?" See, Tobias is looking at this fish and he's getting these instructions to pull out the liver and everything else. He's saying, what's the medicinal point to all of this? To which Azariah, or Raphael, he's called the angel, replies, "As for the fish's heart and liver, you must burn them to make a smoke in the presence of a man or woman afflicted by a demon or evil spirit. And as for the gall, anoint a person's eyes where white films or cataracts have appeared on them. Blow on them, upon the white films, and the eyes will be healed." Friends, that is sympathetic magic. This is what was practiced in the ancient Near East, that you would take pieces and parts of animals and put them together into some kind of a concoction or potion, only to be able to ward off spirits or demons and to be able to heal people with these sort of concoctions. Well, on his wedding night, Tobias is worried that he's going to be the 8th man who dies at the hands of his future wife, Sarah. So we read in verse 17, just a few verses later, the advice is given here. "When you enter the bridal chamber," that's when the demon's going to come and kill you, "take some of the fish's liver and heart and put them on the embers of the incense. An odor will be given off. The demon will smell the odor and flee, and will never be seen near here anymore." Well, again, that a demon would smell, I mean, I know fish, liver, and gall would smell pretty bad, but that a demon would come in and smell this and then flee never to return, that is the definition of sympathetic magic. This is, of course, completely alien to the Old Testament, not to mention the New. Jernest Wright, who was an expert in the Old Testament from Harvard University, says that the whole pagan world of magic and divination is simply incompatible with the worship of Yahweh. The surprising thing is not that the cult of magic and divination was known in Israel, but that it should be so definitely forbidden in the law and associated by the prophets with idolatry. Bruce Metzger, referring to this account, he says the story is entirely unhistorical. The Book of Tobit reflects the admixture of many speculations derived from folklore and magic. And then he cites this example, the view that a demon can be exorcised by means of a disagreeable odor. That's right. What about prayers for the dead? In 2 Maccabees chapter 12, verse 46, we read, "It is therefore a holy and wholesome thought to pray for the dead, that they may be loosed from their sins." Well, you could see that this became a really important passage in the Reformation and Counter-Reformation movements of the 16th century. Because here we have a good verse that describes that we should be praying for the dead so that they could be loosed from their sins. Well, in the context of this passage, the people that are supposed to be getting prayers committed idolatry. They committed a mortal sin. And under the church's view today, you shouldn't pray for someone who died in a mortal sin. This is the sin that leads unto death on their view in 1 John chapter 5. And so even this verse wouldn't be a good verse to support this concept of purgatory or indulgences or almsgiving for the dead or praying to or for the dead. Instead, we see universally through the Old and the New Testament that we never pray to the dead. Deuteronomy 18 says that this is actually a form of idolatry, trying to get in contact with spirits of dead people. Instead, the repeated prayer, the repeated instruction that is given to us is that you are to make your requests known to God. Philippians 4:6, that you're to pray to your heavenly Father. From Jesus, Matthew chapter 6, again and again, you direct your prayers to God, not to the dead or for the dead. We also see that there is the denial of creation from nothing. Or, if you want to be really fancy, you use the Latin creatio ex nihilo, creation from nothing. The wisdom of Solomon, which dates to anywhere from 200 BC to AD 40, usually it's put about 100 BC or so. The wisdom of Solomon, chapter 11, verse 17, says, "Your all-powerful hand, which created the world out of formless matter." Now, repeatedly throughout the Old and New Testament, we see that God created by fiat, that he created from nothing. Psalm 33, "You spoke and it was." Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," which is a merism for the universe, everything in it. In the New Testament, we see the same thing. Here we see the language of Platonism. Indeed, Bruce Metzger of Princeton says the writer here is adopting the very phrase which Platonists use to describe the pre-existent matter out of which the world was made, and implying that this unformed matter was itself uncreated. Now, this doesn't fit with Scripture. It also doesn't fit with nature. Today we know that the universe had a space and time beginning, which is denied here. There also is a what is referred to as a Neoplatonic view of the soul and the body. Neoplatonism comes from the philosopher Plato, but several hundred years later. This was the view that the soul was pure, but the body was soiled, that the body was disgusting. And so the body was really like a cage, and the soul would spring free from the cage in the afterlife to be able to go out into the world, and out of the world and into heaven. And this is precisely what we see in the Apocrypha. Wisdom of Solomon again, chapter 9, verse 15. We read, "A perishable body weighs down the soul, and this earthy tent burdens the thoughtful mind." You see the parallelism? The perishable body, the earthy tent. It's the body burdens the thoughtful mind or soul. The body weighs down the soul. That is the concept of Neoplatonism, that the body is evil and the soul is pure. This is not what we see in our Bibles. Our Bibles have a unity of body and soul. And indeed, the body is so valued that God incarnated into it in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And moreover, we too will be resurrected like Jesus was in our physical bodies. We won't just be flying away to heaven. Heaven will be coming down into the earth. In chapter 16, verse 14, it refers to, quote, "the imprisoned soul," that your soul is imprisoned in the body. Metzger again says, "As for man, his body is regarded as a mere weight and a clog to the soul, a view which is foreign to both Old and New Testament alike." That is certainly true. We see as well the concept of the pre-existence of souls, something that is never taught in the Bible. The Bible instead teaches that we were created by God in the womb, according to Psalm 139, and two, that our souls were formed, were created by God, according to Zechariah. We read, however, in the Wisdom of Solomon, chapter 8, verse 19, "As a child I was naturally gifted, and a good soul fell to my lot, or rather, being good, I entered into an undefiled body." A body like a vacuous shell existing, and then a soul being imbued into it. That just doesn't fit with what we see in our Bibles whatsoever. We see a unity of person. Salvation by works is taught. Tobit chapter 12, verse 9. Almsgiving saves from death and purges away every sin, that by doing good you could get rid of sin. Those who give alms will enjoy a full life, but those who commit sin and do wrong are their own worst enemies. Again, this is not what we see in our Bibles. We see that it's the grace of God transmitted through the cross of Jesus Christ and entered into through the medium or the means of faith. This is the way that we purge sin, that we get rid of sin, is only through the cross of Christ. In addition, there are a tremendous amount of historical inaccuracies. For example, Tobit's lifespan in Tobit 1:4, which dates to 922 BC, where we have the split of the northern tribes. We see that Tobit is referred to as a young man. Yet, by the time of the deportation, getting near the Assyrian deportation of 722, as this is dated, some 182 years later, Tobit is still alive. But that's not the worst of it, because the text itself says in its final chapter, Tobit died in peace when he was 112 years old. And so, not only does he live an extraordinarily long amount of time, but it doesn't even fit with the math that has been passed down to us from secular history. There's historical problems in the book of Judith. Bruce Metzger states the consensus, at least among Protestant and Jewish scholars, is that the story of Judith is sheer fiction. The book teems with chronological, historical, and geographical improbabilities and downright errors. David DeSilva, who's an expert in the Apocrypha, he says the proponents of the book, quote, have to face the many historical and geographical errors of the book. The work is better read as a piece of historical fiction, an attempt to write a non-historical story set in the midst of known historical personages and dynamics. We see this throughout the book of Judith. I can't go into all the details, but here's the references. Incredibly exaggerated numbers throughout this book. Exaggerated rates of travel. We see that Nebuchadnezzar's general travels his army 300 miles in 3 days. Okay, on foot. So that's 100 miles a day. That's nearly 4 marathons per day for 3 days straight. Nebuchadnezzar's reign is in Nineveh instead of Babylon. According to the Apocrypha, they place him in Nineveh. Nineveh fell 7 years before his reign in reality. And so here, as you can see, this isn't lining up with secular history. It isn't even lining up with the other biblical books which mention where Nebuchadnezzar hails from and where he lives and how long his reign lasted. The rebuilding of the temple is dated a century before it occurred. The existence of the Sanhedrin, or the 70-person Supreme Court in Israel, is dated hundreds of years before it came into existence. There's historical problems in Baruch. For one, there's a difficulty because Baruch is the secretary of Jeremiah, and yet this book dates anywhere from 180 to 120 BC. This would mean that it is out of step with Jeremiah, who lived around 560 BC. I mean, we're hundreds of years off. Baruch is in Egypt, according to the book of Jeremiah, and yet he is in Babylon, according to the book of Baruch. The book states that the temple vessels came back to the Jewish people. This never occurred. They never received the temple vessels back after it was sacked under Nebuchadnezzar. Baruch also states that the exile would last for 7 generations, which again, this doesn't even fit with biblical history, where Jeremiah, in Jeremiah, is it 29:10, says that the exile will be 70 years. You'd have to say that a generation is a span of 10 years, something we see nowhere in the Bible. There's historical problems in the additions to Esther, so the form of Esther that is contained in all Bibles is a minimal form. But there are something like three or four additions to the text of Esther, which have been tacked on at the beginning and in the middle and throughout. This is the reason for which I think that many of the Jews and some of the church fathers rejected the book of Esther, is because of these non-canonical additions to the book. Well, regardless, in these spurious or false additions, Mordecai, the cousin of Esther, serves Artaxerxes, but he was a captive of Nebuchadnezzar for 112 years. So the time spans that he could serve Artaxerxes in somewhere between 465 and 425 BC, but then also be able to serve Nebuchadnezzar, these are time spans that are over a century apart. Again, this doesn't even fit with the biblical history, let alone secular history. There's historical problems in Maccabees as well. For one, 1 Maccabees, which is considered to be more historical than 2 Maccabees, 1 Maccabees places this death of Antiochus, Epiphanes IV, it places his death after the rededication of the Jewish temple, after it had been defamed by Antiochus. Whereas 2 Maccabees places the death of Antiochus before the rededication of the temple. When Judas purifies the temple, in 1 Maccabees chapter 4, it says that this was 3 years after the temple was desecrated, whereas in 2 Maccabees chapter 10, it says that this was only 2 years after it was desecrated. 3 Maccabees, 4 Maccabees are completely off the rails. If 1 Maccabees is good history, which I believe it is, and 2 Maccabees is so theologically influenced that it can actually compromise the history given, as we're seeing, 3rd and 4th Maccabees are referred to as historical romance or even Greek romance. Well, by way of conclusion, do you feel comfortable accepting the Apocrypha when these books contain magic incantations, prayers for the dead, the denial of the universe coming into being from nothing, Neoplatonic views of the body and the soul, which are completely alien and contradictory to the Bible and the biblical view, whether Jewish or Christian, the view of salvation by works, which is more strident than anything that we read in modern literature today in different churches. It's actually saying that you could do a good work to purge yourself from sin. This is saying that your good works literally can cancel out your bad works. Whereas modern churches today of any stripe would say that you still need the grace of God and good works can make that faith and everything else come alive. This is actually saying in Tobit, is it chapter 12, that your good works can actually eliminate your evil deeds. And what about the historical inaccuracies? I suppose for some of these, we could argue that perhaps we could harmonize some of them if we tried very hard. But when we see a cumulative case, one after the other, and some of these are, it either happened before or after. It was either this many years or that many years. It was either 180 some years or 112 years. I mean, some of these facts are so far off that yes, they would lead to actual contradictions in some cases. After you look at this cumulative case, doesn't it make you wonder, why are we accepting the Apocrypha again? You know, if the Apocrypha lack good historical and rational grounds, what exactly is the reason for accepting these books?